Just before you listen to today's episode, this is a quick message to remind you that if you like what you hear, you can help support History Hack, which is run entirely by volunteers using our Patreon account. There are links on all of our episodes. Or if a subscription is not your thing, you can also now drop us a line on Ko-fi, which is just the equivalent of buying us a drink. So if you hear an episode, you like it, and you want to chip in just once, then you can do that too. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to today's History Hack. I've got my Chief of Staff with me today. You all right, Wooly?
Hello, boss. How you doing?
I'm good. I'm excited about this one because we always say it and then we don't do anything about it. We don't have enough Irish history on this podcast. There isn't Dorman taking the piss down the pub.
This is true. Dorman, this one's for you. We're doing it properly this time.
We are doing it. We're doing it for Dorman. So who did you find?
So today we have Porrick Coffey, who is the author of This Day in Irish History. Basically, we're going to do a little montage of significant moments in Ireland's history. Porrick has a BA and a Master's from University College Dublin. He's a freelancer for the Sunday Independent, and this is his first book, which is inspired by a social media account that he runs of the same name. Porrick, welcome to History Hack. Great to see you. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Let's just kind of dig a little bit into the reasons behind this. So as I said just now, you have a social media account of the same name. What was the kind of motivation behind setting that up and then taking that as a concept and escalating it into a book?
So I started the social media account about 2018, so almost 4 years ago now. And I started it because I noticed that online on social media, anytime you logged in, you would see people commemorating the anniversary of significant events. It could be somebody's birthday or the day that somebody died, or it could be the day that, if we're talking about history, an agreement was signed or a battle was fought. And I thought the history of Ireland is so vast, as is the history of every country, but the history of Ireland is so vast, but we tend to focus in on specific moments. And, you know, you could theoretically take every single day of the year and find something interesting or significant that happened on that day. And if you were to mark it on social media, I thought people would be particularly interested in it because that's how I think people work. They like to mark occasions, they like to mark anniversaries and so on. So I started there sort of deciding what would I put on each day and researching it and so on. And the reason that I made the leap from social media to the book is social media, as you know, is very, very succinct. And, you know, especially on something like Twitter, you only have about 280 characters, which is about 40 words, if I were to guess on average. And, you know, you really can't get across a lot in that time. You can get across the bare bones of something and you can maybe inspire somebody to seek out more information, whether that's through a book or through going down a rabbit hole on Wikipedia, which I wouldn't always advise because I think Wikipedia is flawed, but it is good for dates and figures and so on. And so writing a book allowed me to expand on that, to go into a little bit more detail. And that's where the book came from, really.
This is really exciting. So what you've done for planning is given us sort of 8 events. And we were talking before we came on air about how you might not necessarily think about these topics in conjunction with Ireland, but it's interesting because they do have this Irish connection, which I'm excited to learn about. So the first one you gave us comes from 1745. So the first maternity hospital in the entirety of the British Empire was founded in Ireland.
That's correct, yeah. So a man called Bartholomew Moss, who was a surgeon from Portlaoise, which is at the time known as Maryborough. It's changed its name since then. He had traveled all throughout England and France and Holland and studying obstetrics and dedicating himself to obstetrics as a surgeon. But he decided to build this maternity hospital in Dublin. And what he did was he purchased or he came into possession of an old building in George's Lane in Dublin, which used to be a theatre. It was actually a 3-story building that used to be a theatre. And there's a famous Irish actress and socialite called Ped Woffington who used to perform there. Let's just put it in a bit of context. But when it started, it was very, very basic. It only had 10 beds, very basic equipment. But it was, as you mentioned, the first maternity hospital in the whole of the British Empire, of which Ireland and many other countries, of course, at the time were a part. And the first patient was admitted shortly afterwards. I think it was the 20th of March that year. Her name was Judith Rochford. And within a year, 208 women, I beg your pardon, had been admitted. And all had delivered, although tragically, 109 was the number of babies who had survived. So there was a tragically high mortality rate in Dublin at the time, as there were in many cities. But this was a significant moment, I think, because of course we have maternity hospitals all over the world now. But it is funny to think that Dublin was where the very, very first one was founded, and it was founded, you know, in the 1700s, so quite a while ago.
That's mad. It's like, what would have made a woman, because obviously for hundreds of years still, oh, like, this is my call, the midwife knowledge coming in now, people are still having babies at home way into the 20th century. So what would have driven a woman to go into hospital? Would it have been like a problem case and a doctor recommended it, or would they just not want to do it at home? Because the norm is to do it at home, isn't it?
Yeah, I suppose it would have been. There must have been a feeling, I suppose, among the women that it was safer to do so. And maybe because of his expertise, Bartholomew Moss would have known that it was safer to do so, because it did become increasingly popular. By 1757, so about 12 years later, 4,000 babies had been born in this hospital, which is known today as the Rotunda Hospital, although technically it did change its location. But and funnily enough, Leinster House, which is the parliament where the Irish government meets, the Dáil, the person who designed that, a man called Richard Castles, was the same person who designed the Rotunda Hospital. So if you mention the Rotunda Hospital to anybody in Dublin, they'll know exactly what you mean. But in terms of why women would have chosen to go there more, I imagine it would have been because of safety, even though you see from that statistic I gave that the infant mortality rate was high. It has improved over time, thankfully. But yeah, I imagine that was probably the reason.
So the Rotunda that you've mentioned, that's going to be the site of many firsts, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm. Exactly, because it was also the site of the first major international conference in the field of obstetrics after the Second World War, which was not held. It was supposed to be, well, I suppose planned to be on the 200th anniversary of the hospital, but that would have been March 1945. Which, as we know, the world was still reeling from the Second World War. So it was actually held in 1947, but it was meant to mark the 200th anniversary. And it was the British Congress of Obstetrics and Gynecology, and they met in the Rotunda and also in the Royal College of Surgeons and Physicians, which is also in Dublin. And today, the Rotunda Hospital is the oldest continuously operated maternity hospital in the world. So that is, I think, an interesting first to think of in terms of Ireland.
Definitely. I just it blows my mind that that's anywhere in the British Empire, including Britain as well. And I like that even going forward now, and that it is still sort of a site of excellence in terms of progression in way things are done with obstetrics and gynecology as well. It's a good one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
We're going to move on to another good one now, which is Martin's Law. I'm not going to spoil this one, but just tell us, first of all, about Martin's Law. What did it actually seek to do?
So Martin's Law was the first piece of animal welfare legislation introduced in the world. The full title of it was the Cruel and Improper Treatment of Cattle Act, and it was introduced 22nd of July 1822. It became known as Martin's Law because it was introduced by a man called Richard Martin, sometimes known as Dick Martin or Humanity Dick Martin, and he was a representative of Galway County. Galway's in the west of Ireland, as many people will know. So he was a member of parliament in the House of Commons. At the time, there was no Irish parliament. There had been one in the late 1700s, which was abolished, and Ireland, representatives of Ireland took up their seats in the House of Commons. And he was very much concerned with the welfare of animals. Richard Martin. The law that was brought in said that anyone who had wantonly and crudely beaten, abused or ill-treated animals, such as horses, cows or sheep, would be fined no less than 10 shillings and no more than £5, provided that a complaint was made to a justice of the peace or a magistrate within 10 days of the offence in question. So the reason that I think Dick Martin had this concern for animals, he had studied at the Harrow School under Samuel Parr. And Samuel Parr famously said that, quote, "He that can look with rapture upon the agonies of an unoffending and unresisting animal will soon learn to view the sufferings of a fellow creature with indifference." So Samuel Parr, of course, had been very passionate in protecting animals. And this he had instilled this into Dick Martin, Richard Martin. So the law was introduced in 1822. And from there, 2 years later, Martin co-founded the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, along with 20 other people, including William Wilberforce. And then 2 years later, it was granted royal status by Queen Victoria, and it became the RSPCA, the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals. And then 11 years after that, 11 years after the initial Martin's Act, the Cruelty to Animals Act 1835 was introduced, which consolidated further protections in law for animals. So this one was sort of, I think it's very much part of British history as well, because it was a British law. The reason that I think it's interesting is because, of course, Richard Martin was a representative of an Irish constituency, because Ireland was part of the UK at the time. He had an interesting background. His parents were both Catholics, but at the time, Catholics were not able to take up their seats in the House of Commons. That would change shortly afterwards with the Roman Catholic Relief Act of 1829. So his parents had raised him Protestant for the purposes of his being able to sit in Parliament, because at the time they had a thing called the Test Act, which meant you had to renounce your Roman Catholic faith if you were to sit in Parliament, which of course is gone today. But so he did have an interesting background, but very much part of British history, but also an interesting kind of part of Irish history also.
How much of a fight did he have to get it through Parliament? Was this something that he had to kind of keep coming back to and work up to?
I'm not fully aware, to be honest with you. I imagine there would have been some resistance at the time, because, of course, livestock agriculture would have been a huge part of Britain and Ireland at the time. Nevertheless, he was successful in getting it through, and his subsequent career proves it isn't something that he was happy with once it had gone through. He kept going back in terms of founding what became the RSPCA and so on. In terms of how much resistance he had, I actually don't know. I would need to look into that further.
I want to move next, going forward a couple of decades, to asking you what happens in Ireland on the 3rd of June, 1844.
We're also going back to medicine here after the first mention, and the hypodermic needle being used for the first time.
I did not know that that was invented by an Irishman.
That's true, yeah. So Francis Rind was a doctor who worked in Dublin's Meath Hospital, which has been since incorporated into Talla Hospital, which is sort of outside Dublin City. It's in the county of Dublin. And he invented this device, and I'm sure there would have been parallel, very similar inventions at the time, but he's credited with inventing this device, the hypodermic needle, that year, because he had a patient who was suffering from quite an intense bit of pain in her face. Her name was Margaret Cox, and in order to deal with this, she had been drinking a solution that had morphine in it, but it wasn't being as effective as it might have been. So what he did was he created an improvised syringe with a small tube, and he allowed morphine to flow through it. So he kind of pierced her skin. So when we think about the hypodermic needle today, I mean, we're talking about a very, very early version of it. It's not, it wouldn't really stack up with what we have today. But nonetheless, it was a first at the time. And a couple of years later, in March 1846, in the Dublin Medical Press, Francis Rind wrote an article about this. And it sort of explained how he had created it and how he had helped this patient. What he said was, it's a little bit of a long quote, but I'll read it. In the space of a minute, all pain, except that caused by the operation, which was very slight, had ceased, and she slept better that night than she had for months. After the interval of a week, she had slight return of pain in the gums of both upper and under jaw. The fluid was again introduced by two punctures made in the gum of each jaw, and the pain disappeared. She left the hospital on the 1st of August in high spirits and promised to return if she ever felt the slightest pain again. So you could already see that this was a very effective form of treatment that he had kind of come up with, Francis Rind. And of course, it's been used billions of times around the world. Florence Nightingale famously used it in the Crimean War in 1866, and even she referred to it as a curious little newfangled operation. Her actual quote is, "Nothing did me any good but a curious little newfangled operation of putting opium under the skin, which relieves one for 24 hours." So anytime you see a hypodermic needle in use today, you can sort of trace that back to Dublin in the mid-19th century.
So Florence Nightingale was taking opium?
According to her own words, yes. But I think that might have been more par for the course back then than it would be today.
Just struck me as surprising.
Yeah, Zach, I think if we had a chat about Florence Nightingale, quite a few things would surprise you about stuff that she wrote down. But let's move on. I'm a little bit squeamish about the idea of the principle of just stabbing this woman in the face with a new invention. Now people get Botox all the time. Like, it's like, whatever. But at the time, if you've got a doctor coming, she must have been in some amount of pain to go, stab me in the face with that pointy thing that I've never seen in my life before and that no one's ever heard of. She must have been in some pain to take that.
Yeah, absolutely. I imagine so. But it worked in the long run, so it's good.
Yeah, I mean, it does. It said that she was to come back if she felt any pain again, but you didn't find anything of that. And they've named the stuff named after him, isn't there?
Yeah, the phlebotomy service in Tallaght University Hospital is called the Rind Unit in honour of them. So those who study medicine in Dublin in the Tallaght Hospital would be aware of him. But he's not as widely known as you might think. So it's nice to get a mention of him today.
Definitely.
So we're going to move on to something a bit more kind of perhaps in Alex and mine's wheelhouse, which is warfare, basically. Blowing stuff up. So we're going to talk about a torpedo, the Brennan torpedo. Question of ignorance here before we start kind of talking about the invention itself and the guy behind it. Is this the first torpedo or the first successful test?
I think it's the first practical guided missile. So there would have been torpedoes beforehand, but this one was, I suppose, the first one that was practically guided, which was successful. So saying it's the very first torpedo is probably not the case. I'm sure someone with more expertise than I have would be able to correct me if I were to say that. But it did end up becoming quite a successful weapon of war. And it was designed by a man called Louis Brennan, who was, again, this is sort of an example of how Irish history sort of blends in with the history of other countries, because you could say this was an Australian first, really, because he lived most of his life outside of Ireland, Louis Brennan. It was in Australia where he tested it in Melbourne, but he was born in Ireland. He was born in Castlebar, in the west of Ireland, in 1852, beg your pardon, which many people will know that was kind of during the period just after or at the very end of the famine, which was, of course, a calamitous event in Irish history, massive loss of population there. And in fact, he had 10 siblings, five of whom are said to have died during the famine. So quite a tragic story, which, again, wouldn't have been unusual. We touched upon the infant mortality rate earlier in Dublin. So when he was 9 years old, Louis Brennan and his family moved to Melbourne. But he'd always had an interest in innovation and in technology and so on. He's been described as, this is a quote from the Irish Times, which is the sort of the best-selling newspaper in Ireland, surely Ireland's most remarkable inventor. And what he invented, which became to be known as the Brennan torpedo, was the world's first practical guided missile. And the first that I mentioned in the book is the 21st of March, 1879, in Hobson's Bay, Melbourne, where he tested this missile. And by the standards of modern weapons, it probably wasn't that impressive. It went for 400 yards for just over a minute at 11 knots, but it did hit its target. And there were journalists and other people present on the day. And it was said to have excited wonder and approbation. He'd been granted a patent for the invention the year before in 1879. The full title of it was Improvements in Machinery for Propelling and Guiding Vessels on Land and Through Air and Water. So quite a cumbersome title, as you can imagine, for a lot of inventions at the time would have had. But this went on to be used quite a lot for defence. In 1887, the British Parliament agreed to the payment of £110,000, which was an enormous amount of money at the time, to the War Office for the exclusive use of this torpedo. And since then, it's been used everywhere from Malta to Hong Kong. Production discontinued in 1906, but nonetheless, it was for many decades sort of the go-to for guided missiles and invented by an Irish person.
So what made this particularly great? What was so kind of, I'm not sure if revolutionary is quite the right word, but what was the fuss, inverted commas, about when it came to this whole propulsion thing? Do we have any sense of this being a sort of a watershed moment? Because in time, as you say, you know, 1906, it gets phased out. What is it about this that makes it really key for this period of history?
I believe it was its accuracy, because of course there would have been many other similar weapons at the time, but you can't be assured of how successful they would be, and this was much more precise. Brennan was involved in other inventions in his lifetime, but this is the one that he's most remembered for, and the fact that the War Office was to receive so much money for it shows that it was more reliable perhaps than other maybe competing weapons at the time.
Is this the invention that makes him then? After this, is it all kind of, does he end up with a lot of commissions? Or is this kind of the high point of his career and it's all downhill from here?
I wouldn't say that it's all downhill from here. But it is probably the one that he is most remembered for. He also worked a lot with monorails and trains and railways and that kind of thing, which a little bit less destructive. I've heard, funnily enough, because of the social media site, I get a lot of people commenting and so on. And some people have said, you know, this isn't something that we should celebrate, and perhaps that we should focus more on his work with locomotives. But it was probably the one that he is most remembered for, although he did have a long and varied career that isn't really gone into in the book. The book really just covers this one event because it's sort of, I think, the one that most people would be interested in.
I like it. We're not just going to talk about men, though, are we? So tell us why 22-year-old Una Kyo makes it in.
So Una Kyo was a woman who was the first stockbroker admitted to the Dublin Stock Exchange, which it is said, and again, there may be someone with more expertise who could contradict this, but it is said that she is the world's first woman stockbroker. So she was admitted in 1925. And if you wanted to look at other major cities around the world, like New York or London, the first woman was admitted to the New York Stock Exchange in 1967. Wow. And the first woman was admitted to the London Stock Exchange in 1973. So quite a long time later. And this isn't to say that women in Ireland are decades ahead. Anybody who has a knowledge of Irish history, particularly contemporary Irish history, will tell you that is not the case. But that's why I found it so interesting that she was the first woman to stockbroker in the world, according to what is written about her.
I really like it. So tell us about how she got her job then.
So her father had been a stockbroker too. His name was Joseph Kyo. At the time, in order to become a stockbroker, you needed an application fee of £500, and you also needed to hold securities of more than £2,000. So quite a bit of money at the time. And she needed, obviously, people to vouch for her. So her father did, and so did a man called Patrick Hogan, who was the Minister for Agriculture in the Irish states, the very, very new fledgling Irish states at the time, which had only recently become independent of the UK in 1922. But that was her entry point into the world of being a stockbroker.
But there was some opposition, wasn't there, when she first, I mean, she has this money to put up, like the £2,500 to put up, but not everybody's happy.
Yeah, it wasn't sure whether she would be able to apply, but there was no way of stopping her. So a few weeks after her application, she was approved. But absolutely, there was opposition. And she even spoke about this herself years later in 1971. She said that one of the disadvantages in those days was that women did not socialize in men. This is her quote, with men in lounges and pubs. And when the men retired to Jury's, which is a hotel in Dublin, to relax after transacting business, I could not accompany them. So even though we could look at this and say what a fantastic achievement it was for her, it would be wrong to say that she did not face opposition even during her career and before her career began.
And she it goes through the Minister of Finance, is that right? That's what gets her through the door.
That's true. Yeah. It was necessary for the Minister of Finance to approve her application, which then brought her on to the Dublin Stock Exchange, which she did. She remained active on, but not for that long, really. She retired in 1939, and she sort of had fallings out with her father. They did clash a little. She began trading on his behalf when he fell ill shortly after she joined the Dublin Stock Exchange, but it wasn't all smooth sailing. And then later in life, after her retirement, she basically moved to rural Ireland, and she lived for quite a long time. She died in 1988, so 60 plus years after she was admitted, but still a first that I think not enough people are aware of, and something that would be worthy of exploration in more detail if someone were to write like a biography of Una Keogh, I think.
Yeah, I think the two things that struck me firstly were that it brings her into conflict with her dad while mm-hmm. she's sort of, because she trades on his behalf, doesn't she? And then she's doing his business for him. So mm-hmm. not even he can handle the idea of his daughter doing it. But also as well, this idea that she does the same job as them, makes mm-hmm. people money. And then when they all go for drinks after work, she doesn't.
Mm-hmm. She mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's just, home. Is an indication of, yeah, exactly. The sort of the social barriers that existed for women at the time, and you know, to a lesser extent exists today, but you know, there are still those barriers there, and if you can imagine, you know, the 80s, the 90s, the 70s, I mean, we're talking about, you know, the very, very early 20th century. So yeah, huge barriers in place for women in the workplace.
This next one's a bit grim. We're going to talk about somebody being burnt at the stake. What made you want to include this particular story in your book?
So this is probably the oldest entry we're going to talk about today. It was the 3rd of November, 1324. The reason I wanted to include it is it is quite an interesting story. When you're dealing with history this far long ago, a lot of the details are lost. You can't be as precise as you might want to be. But this was the first time that witchcraft and heresy had been linked in either Ireland or Britain at the time. So probably in the wider world also a first. A woman called Petronilla de Meath was burned at the stake, and quite a grim story. She had been flogged as well several times, so not exactly a moment of celebration, but quite interesting when we think about, you know, the Salem witch trials and subsequent history that we're all aware of, that the first of this happened in the early 1300s in Ireland.
So tell us about her and her story, because it's not just her that's involved in this, is it? You've got somebody called Alice Kyteller as well.
Yeah, that's correct. She was actually Petronilla de Meath. She was the maidservant to Alice Kyteller, Dame Alice Kyteller, who had been married three times and had been suspected of being a witch. Now, I say suspected of being a witch. Most people listening to this today probably don't have a belief in witchcraft. Maybe they do, but it would have been much more widely spread at the time. But she had actually fled Ireland at the time of this scandal, as it were. What happened was that her husband, John Lepore, he became ill, and her children went to the Bishop of Ossory in Kilkenny, where she lived, Kilkenny in Ireland. And it was he who led these accusations of witchcraft against her. She then left Ireland. And it was, unfortunately, her maidservant who was linked to these crimes, was flogged and was burnt at the stake. So quite a brutal end for this young woman.
The whole story around Kyteller is quite bizarre, really, isn't it? I mean, she's said to have renounced Christ. Tell us about the potions as well. And there's some, looking through the notes, it's just pure history hack. You've got unbaptized babies, you've got dead men's fingernails. This is all quite peculiar.
Yeah, this is what she was accused of doing. She was accused of having renounced Christ. She was accused of having made potions in the skull of a convicted criminal, and of, as you said, using unbaptized babies and men's fingernails. So quite a grim, evocative image you can imagine there, probably as grim as you could get. And she was excommunicated from the church and had her property confiscated. So although she left and she avoided the worst of this, which was to say being flogged and being burnt at the stake, she did suffer as a result of this. Although there was a sort of a button to this story, because she returned to Ireland later on, and she lived, after she left Ireland, she lived under the protection of Edward III. And later, a few years later, I believe it was 1329, she had the Bishop of Ossory's revenues seized, and he was accused of heresy. So she kind of turned the tables on him, and then he left Ireland and did not return until the 1340s. So it became this drama. Now, what I'm giving is obviously a very, 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 very short version of the history. And there are historians of that period who would be able to go into far more detail and maybe even pick up one or two things that are not accurate. But nonetheless, I thought it was a great story. You know, if you can talk about these things in terms of there being great stories, witchcraft, convicted criminals, skulls, unbaptized babies, flogging, burn at the stake. Obviously, there was a real person here. It's, you know, you wouldn't forget that, but still a really interesting and grim story.
Why doesn't Petronilla get out with Caetella? Does Alice Caetella just kind of leave her behind? Or because, I mean, maidservant, you'd think, well, maybe a member of the household, you'd take them with you. So
I'm not fully sure. I imagine maybe it was a case of her having to get out urgently, and therefore one of the cases where Petronilla was not able to get out with her. But I mean, I doubt she threw her to the wolves, as it were. I'd say it was just one of those things, unfortunate things, where sadly the maid servant was bore the brunt of the punishment that was meted out at the time.
I think we should stick with women for the next one. We're still in the 20. Oh, we're still going back now to the same sort of era as Una, to talk about Lillian Bland. Now, this was the one on your list that I had already heard of. So Lillian Bland, who was she and why does she make it onto the list?
So Lillian Bland was actually born in Kent in England, but her father was a native of Carnmany in County Antrim, which is north of Belfast. And she was the first woman in the world to construct and pilot her own plane, which was a phenomenal achievement at the time. She had moved back to County Antrim after the death of her mother, but she'd been obsessed with the Wright brothers ever since they had taken off in the early 1900s. And she'd been obsessed with aviation and so on. So what she did is she started building planes in her uncle's workshop. She started with models, things that would be flown with a kite. And then she created her first full-scale attempt at a plane, which was called the Mayfly. And the reason it was called the Mayfly, according to her, is that she said it may fly or it may not. So it was kind of a witty name. Yeah, yeah, quite. And so she built this plane herself, and she took off from Shane's Castle Estate in Randallstown, County Antrim, on the 31st of August, 1910. She didn't go very high. She was about 30 feet off the ground. She for about a quarter of a mile, but still huge achievement at the time. When she was building the plane, she actually went to Manchester herself to get an air cooled engine and brought it back. She'd ordered it, but there had been delays. So the fact that she, you know, left her home, went to Manchester to get this engine, brought it back, paid £100 for it at the time as well. It showed how kind of dedicated she was. She wasn't going to sit back and wait for things to be delivered to her. She was very, very much a get up and go kind of person. So this was, I thought, really interesting. You know, we all know about Amelia Earhart, who also gets mentioned in the book, even though she's not Irish, but she does get mentioned in the book. But I thought this was a really interesting, interesting moment that this woman to have built and piloted her own plane for the first time.
I really like this. I just love her. I love her just pig-headedness with getting it together. And I love the name. What did she have to say about the experience of putting this aeroplane together and getting it off the ground?
So she wrote to a magazine at the time called Flight Magazine, which is all about aviation. And she described the process of building it. And this is what she said, and kind of show how independent she was. She said, "I made her entirely myself, with the exception of the metal clips and, of course, the sockets, strainers, etc., which were bought from English firms. I think she's the first biplane made in Ireland." So clearly somebody who knows her stuff, who's done her research, who's really focused and dedicated on it. And and the result is this first in aviation. Another thing about it is, of course, the fact that she was a woman did play a part in this. And years later, when she was 88 years old, she told the Western Morning News, which is a newspaper. She said, "I could hardly believe it. I had proved wrong the many people who had said that no woman could build an airplane, and that gave me great satisfaction." So it shows to show it was a first in aviation. It was also a first for a woman and for achievements that maybe some people would not have thought women capable of.
Really of a way to stick it to the patriarchy, wasn't it?
Yeah.
So you don't think women need the vote. You don't think women can build a plane. You don't think women can fly. Well, I've done two of those things. Maybe it's time for the third to come around. We're going to stay in the early 20th century for the last one. Alex is jealous that I've nicked this one.
I know. I'm like, how did I let this happen? How did I let this go the wrong way around?
I know. But you got your planey stuff, so no complaints, because we're going to talk about the first tank, aren't we?
We are.
Yeah. So the first tank was first used in 1916 during the First World War, obviously, but it had its origins. It was sort of the brainchild of more than one person. But the reason I'm linking it back to Ireland is that it was an engineer from Blackrock in Dublin called Walter Gordon Wilson, who was responsible for one of the most unique things about the first tank. It was used at the Battle of Fleurs-Corcelette in France, when 49 British tanks were assigned to reach the German lines, which were a mile away. Now, they weren't all successful, only 9 of them were. But as a result of this new weapon of war, Field Marshal Douglas Haig ordered 1,000 more of them. Now, Walter Gordon Wilson, just as a bit of background on him, as I mentioned, he was from Blackrock in Dublin. He's been described as a genius, quote unquote, a genius with things like gearboxes. And he'd also been a Royal Naval Volunteer Reserve officer. So a little bit of background. February 1915, Winston Churchill established the Admiralty Landships Committee, which was to help the stalemate in the Western Front during the First World War. And so much of what we think of as tanks was being designed at the time. But of course, there were these thick trenches and the vehicles were only going so far and they were collapsing in. And what Walter Gordon Wilson did, which still something we think about today when we think about tanks, was he overcame the problem of their getting over trenches, which was to design tracks which looped around the entire body of the vehicle. The prototype for this was a vehicle called Mother. So that's basically it. It wasn't in terms of warfare. I mean, when we think about achievements of warfare, it wasn't a tremendous gain on the Germans. They only gained 5 miles on them. But, you know, we still talk about the tank today. In fact, Bovington Tank Museum has a line here about this particular tank that was built. The direct military impact of the tank can be debated, but its effect on the Germans was immense. It caused bewilderment, terror, and concern in equal measure.
So they literally run away screaming when they see these things, because the secret is so well kept in September 16. And the Germans have not jumped on this technology at all. It's completely passed them by, and they literally crap their pants when they see these things belching fire from machine guns and coming towards them. So, yeah, the morale victory is quite something.
I should mention also William Tritton, who was the managing director of an agricultural machinery company called William Foster & Co. in Lincoln in England, who began working on this, you know, armored vehicle at the time and became known as Little Willie. So it was he and Wilson who worked together who came up with it, but it was Wilson who came up with the looped tracks, which is why it was so successful, even though we may not think of it as being that successful, but why it was so successful compared to maybe other prototypes that had been developed at the time.
So that Wilson's not done when it comes to the tank after that point, is he? What's his role as things progress over the course of the war?
So after Mother was designed, that it was built in 99 days, Wilson went on to the Metropolitan Carriage and Wagon Company near Birmingham, and he supervised the manufacture of Mark I tanks, 125 of which were ordered from Metropolitan and 25 from Lincoln, from the company that I mentioned earlier. And yeah, it went on from there. And then they were the ones that were used in the First World War.
Yeah, and to think that so much in terms of revolution and tactical doctrine comes out of that one invention. So one guy having a massive impact, not just in the history of the war, but also world history and the way in which wars are fought. Porik, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us. Just tell people, remind them about the book's name, where they can get it. Hint, don't go to Amazon, people. Find other ways of buying it. But also how they can find you, because you're on Twitter.
Yeah, so thanks very much again for having me. The name of the book is This Day in Irish History by Porik Coffey. You can get it from all the usual places you would get books. If it isn't in your local bookstore, I'm sure they could order it in for you. Certainly Waterstones or WH Smith, but I mean, if you wanted to go somewhere more independent, you could go down that route. And as for online and on Twitter and Facebook and so on, it's just the handle This Day Irish, so the three words together, there's no underscores or spaces there. And yeah, I update that every day pretty much. Most of what I update relates back to something in the book, so if you see something you're interested in, you can always get more information from the book, although occasionally I'll include something that I didn't have time to work into the book, because you are limited. Even when you write something like this, you are limited. You can't talk about everything. You have to sort of pick and choose. But yeah, I'd absolutely love it if anyone who was interested were to give me a follow there.
Fantastic. There you go, folks. You know what to do. Porik, it's been great. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
When our guests join us to talk about their work and their new book, the 45 minutes or so they spend with us is just a taster of all their efforts. So to this end, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest and greatest books. You can support them, and you can support History Hack too. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep at it and bring you more amazing guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or just search on bookshop.org for us under the shops bit. Thank you for your continued support, and here's to your next great book.